Okay, yes, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 1945, just before the war ended. And I grew up for the first few years anyway with a fairly wealthy family. My grandfather had been the owner of a steel company, Crucible Steel. And without getting into things too deeply, I guess he forgot to pay the income tax and the business tax on the company, and he ended up losing everything. And Crucible Steel ended up becoming U.S. Steel. So, but that happened when I was about 5 or 6 years old, a long time ago. So the family split and lost everything, basically. And just after that, my parents got a divorce, and my grandparents moved from Wisconsin down to Florida, and were followed shortly by my father, and then my mother went after. There were four of us kids. The kids split up also. I had a brother, two sisters, and the family kind of split up at the same time. And when I was 6 or 7, like I said, I moved down to Florida, where I was raised for the most part by my grandparents, and for a while, my mother. When I was 15, my father passed away, and at that time I was living with my mother and one of my sisters. I was kind of an unruly kid. 15, 16 years old, I used to run away. It was arguments with the mother, and I guess it was just my way of fighting back. I didn't know what I was doing, but I had a lot of problems as a kid. I've been picked up a couple of times. I remember once I ran away from home, middle of the night, and I had to find a place to sleep. So I found a nice comfy place on a rooftop in downtown Van Nuys. Crawled underneath an air conditioning system, and I was just getting asleep, and all of a sudden I heard a racket on all sides of the roof, and there were cops that came in from three different sides and jumped on me. Unbeknownst to me, there were folks downstairs in this business cleaning up, and they heard some nonsense on the roof up there and some moving around. So they thought it was a burglar. And the cops showed up and jumped on me and slapped me around a little bit, cuffed me up, thinking I was a burglar. And they took me down. They found out I was 16 at the time. And so they called my mother, and kind of an embarrassing situation for her. But that kept on for a while. And I had problems in school. Did go out for athletics. I was a runner, cross country, track, lettered and all of that. That was my one getaway, I guess, as a young kid, running. And I used to run a lot. And I could, I was thinking about other things when I ran. And it was cathartic, I guess, for me to do that. But I was a runner, that was the one thing I really enjoyed, getting away and just running through the hills or down the streets or wherever. I went to four different high schools because of the moving around, and ended up at a Catholic boys' school in San Pedro in 1963. I wanted to join the Navy when I was 17. My mother, of course, wouldn't sign. She wouldn't put up with that. So it was a rough last year for her in the high school until I graduated. Decided I wanted to go into the Marine Corps. So I signed up for the Marine Corps, and as things worked out, 6 days after I graduated from high school, I found myself in boot camp in San Diego. But it wasn't easy for me to get there either. It's week after I, like I said, graduated from high school, I got orders to report to the Greyhound bus depot in downtown Los Angeles, where I would meet up with several hundred other young men at that time, all young men. We're going to go to various branches of the service, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, whatever. And it was on a Saturday morning. And we met at the, everybody went to the Grand Bus Depot. And we were told by the employees there that we're supposed to have a seat here in this large room. And like I said, I believe there are about 400 young guys in there. And they said, when your branch of the service is called, you're to rise up and go to the gate number that's called for you. We should be getting everybody out of here this morning type of thing. So they started calling different branches. I think the Army was first. I forget that. It was Fort Bragg or somewhere in Northern California. They said all personnel for the U.S. Army rise and they go to gates. And there were three or four gates that they'd mentioned to board their Greyhound buses and go to boot camp. So after they called the Army, I guess about two-thirds, if not more, the young guys got up and they all left. And like I said, there was probably 150, 200 left. Then they called the Navy, all personnel from the U.S. Navy, get out and report to gate so-and-so. And a bunch of you guys got up and they walked down and reported down to the buses and got on the buses. A little while later, they call all personnel for the Air Force. For I believe it was Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, rise and go up or down down here and get on these buses. And this went on for about three and a half hours, and everybody was up, and all of a sudden I realized that everybody was gone. And I was sitting there by myself. I felt a little funny, a little self-conscious, and I said to myself, I know the Marine Corps was small. Not a lot of folks went into the Marine Corps, so maybe that's it. So I continued to sit there, and something told me something was wrong when I got in the afternoon. I wasn't a real bright kid right out of high school. So I went up to the lady, and I said, I've been waiting for the Marine Corps to be called, and the Marine Corps hadn't been called yet, and I just wondered if maybe the bus is going to be leaving, or should I continue to sit here? And she looked at me like I had three heads. She said, well, the naval personnel left 3 hours ago. Where were you? I said, sitting right here. I said, I'm not going to the Navy, though. I said, I'm going to the Marine Corps. She says, well, the Marine Corps is part of the Navy service. You should have been on the bus for San Diego. And I felt like a real fool. So she said, all right, you go over there and sit down. I'm going to make a phone call. So she did. I'm sitting there, and now I'm thinking, oh, this is the end of the world for me. And she called me back about 10 minutes later, and she called me up. She says, all right, here's a meal ticket. You're going to get a meal over here, and you're going to listen for bus so-and-so. And they're going to leave, I think it was at, 10:30, 10:45 that night. It's kind of late. For San Diego, make sure you listen, and make sure you're on that bus. And when you get to the bus depot in San Diego, here's a phone number you're supposed to call. Tell them who you are. Tell them where you are. And they will have someone pick you up. And so I said, fine, okay. And so we went through the whole thing and got on the bus. And we got out of L.A. probably, it had to be around 11 o'clock, it was very late. And we're driving down to San Diego on the Greyhound, and it's very quiet on the bus. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm in for it now. Everybody is already down there, and what are they going to do to me when I show up late? So I ended up in San Diego, got off the bus, made the phone call, and the Marine, I guess, who answered the phone said, go outside in front of the Greyhound bus depot, stand on the corner, and someone will meet you there. So I said, okay. And so I did as I was instructed, and I went outside. I'm standing on the corner, nobody around, all by myself, very dark. And all of a sudden, an old Marine Corps pickup truck pulls up. It had to be like probably a 1953, a 1954, one of the old trucks that they had with a Marine Corps emblem on the side. And he pulls to the curb, and there's a young corporal in there driving it. He looks out at me. He says, "You Lang?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Well, get in." So I get in the front, and we took off, presumably for the boot camp right there in San Diego, right, which is right next to the San Diego airport. He looks over at me and says, "A little late today, huh?" I said, "Well, yes, I get on the bus, and, you know, I didn't realize that the Marine Corps was part of the Navy, and I didn't know what else to say," and he didn't say anything until we got to the gate. We went through the front gate, the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, and we pulled up next to the parade ground, and again, nobody was there. It's pitch black, and a couple of lights in the distance. But there was one lit area right in front of us with these yellow footprints at a 45-degree angle. And obviously what they were for, when the young recruits would come in, they'd have you stand in those footprints at a 45-degree angle, which was the position of attention in not just the Marine Corps, but in the military. And so he says, "Stand in those footprints and somebody will be here to take care of you." And I said, "Okay." And so I got out and went over, and I'm standing in the footprints, and there's dozens of them. I'm standing there all by myself. He says, "When you stand there, put your hands at your sides, look straight ahead, don't move your head, don't move your arms," and that's the position of attention. And so I did that, and I'm standing there for maybe 5-10 minutes, and again, it's very quiet, very dark, nobody's around. And off in the distance, I can hear a couple of guys that sound like they're talking. And every now and again, I hear a laugh, and they're talking about something else, and I can barely hear what they're saying. And I'm standing there, 20 minutes later, 30 minutes later, and I'm thinking, well, maybe they forgot about me, and I should look where that voice is across the parade ground over here, and maybe go over there and tell them what I ask them what I should do, because I've been here for quite a while. And then I'm thinking, no, he was pretty stern. He wants me to stay right here. So I'm thinking, well, I can stay here for as long as I want, because I was in really good physical condition because they ran all the time. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, I'll play their game and I'll wait them out. So quite a while went by. And I mean, it may have been going on an hour or so. It just seemed longer because I couldn't hear much and it was dark and nobody was around. But I was still standing there, and all of a sudden I hear something way off to my right, the other side of the parade ground, and I hear a screen door slam, and I kind of look over there and glance when I probably shouldn't, but I did anyway. And there's a guy coming across the parade ground in a t-shirt, and he's just kind of taking his time walking across, and he's walking towards me. So I'm thinking, well, this must be for me. He's coming over here. It's got to be. Nobody else is around. So it's got to be, I mean, 1:30 in the morning at least. It's very late. So he comes around. He's walking towards me, and all of a sudden, I lose him out of my peripheral vision. I didn't want to look over there because, you know, now I'm in boot camp, and I've been told, do exactly as you're told. You're going to have a lot of problems. So I'm sitting straight ahead, and I've lost sight of him. I don't know where he is. And I don't know if he's coming towards me eventually, or he went off and did something else. And I'm thinking, well, I'll just stay do what I was told, and I'll stand all night if I have to. And so I'm standing like this, and a minute or two passes, and all of a sudden, it's like a truck hit me from behind. Well, the guy did find me, and he came up behind me and kicked me right in the butt, and all I hear him say, "You are too fucking slow, move." And I'm on the ground, I get myself picked up, and he kicks me again. And they're kicking me across the parade ground, and then he grabs me and throws me towards the screen door that he had come out of, all the way across. And so I'm half running, half crawling up there, and getting knocked down every few feet. But we made it to the gate, to the screen door, and he opens it, and he says, "Get in there." And he, as I'm coming through, he grabs me by the shirt, and he throws me into a barber's chair, and I'm sitting in the barber's chair, and another guy comes over with a razor that's already going. He goes, "Zip, zip, zip." That's when I had hair. It took maybe 10 seconds, and I don't have any hair now. And he said, "All right, get in the shower, take a shower, and throw your clothes out here," civilian clothes. And then he threw me some more clothes, a yellow sweatshirt that said USMC and some other stuff. get out of the shower, get dressed, get over here. And so I did that, and they're yelling and they're cussing, and I'm running, dropping the soap and doing this and other. So I'm in the shower maybe a minute and a half. He said, I dry off getting these clothes here, and so I did. And he said, all right, shithead, this is the deal here. You're late, you lost your platoon. You're going to what we call receiving barracks. And you're going to go over there and do exactly as you told. Do you understand it? Well, yes, but I said, you don't say you to me, asshole. I told you what to do. Do you understand me? Yes, well, as you carry, well, yes, sir. What do you mean, yeah? Yes, sir. And I said, well, yes, sir. I said, you're going to go through that hatchway. And I didn't know what a hatchway was. Well, in the Marine Corps, a hatchway is a doorway. You go through it. She says, you're going to go through and report across to this area. And I said, oh, yes, sir. And because I'm not used to calling people sir. Again, I was a really idiot as a kid. I didn't know all that stuff. So I ended up what they call receiving barracks for 3 weeks. And the Marine Corps, and I guess most of the services do it anyway, you should come in with a group and train from day one. And that was their philosophy. If you don't, you're going to wait around in no man's land until we get enough people to form a recruit platoon. And that's what happened. I was the first one to form this platoon, which, by the way, was Platoon 337. And you never forget these little things, even years later, decades later. So during that 3 weeks, I had to work in the scullery, they call it, cleaning up pots in the kitchen there and swabbing decks, cleaning places. I was outside doing landscaping and pulling weeds, getting yelled at for 3 weeks. The good thing was I got to eat three times a day and basically sleep at night until the sun came up and up early, like at 5:30 or 6. And I worked all day doing all of these jobs that they had around there. And gradually, over the 3 weeks, more young guys would come in. And we were building the platoon. And they were scared to death, as everybody else was. And there was a lot of people getting yelled at and kicked at. But no real physical. I mean, you know, they didn't draw blood or really hurt somebody. I mean, they wanted to intimidate you and see how much of that you could take. During that receiving period, a couple of guys took off. And like I said, we're right next to the airstrip. And there was only one place to run. You couldn't run out the main gate because somebody would grab you. They went over the fence into the San Diego airport area. And they were runaways and ended up being unfit. I guess they didn't take them into boot camp. But I was going to stay. And I knew that this wasn't really reality. And things would change eventually. So eventually we built a platoon and we were there for, I think it was 6 months, 5-6 months. And I saw that through. And during that time, it was rough and a lot of mental strain, a lot of yelling and screaming. And again, we lost a couple more people who went over the fence, probably shouldn't have been there to begin with. But we got through it, and next thing was the infantry training regiment. We went to Pentland for 4 weeks of that, which was a little different because they started to ease up on a lot of things because now we had to learn our craft, which was the infantry. And then we got 30 days leave and were assigned back. And I got assigned to an infantry company at Camp Pentland, 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, where I stayed for 2 years, and a lot of training, a lot of infantry training. The Marine Corps is big on training, desert training, jungle training, beach training for 2 years. And then in March of 1965, as is with all Marine Corps battalions at the time, you have an overseas tour, usually in the Far East. And it was in March of 65, that we boarded the USS Breckinridge in San Diego to go overseas. And we were, our ultimate destination was Okinawa. At this time, things were heating up in Vietnam, and we'd already had troops in Vietnam, and we were told that we would be ending up in Vietnam instead of our regular tour. That would have taken us to Japan, training and winter training in the mountains and Okinawa. We stopped in Hawaii on the way for a little Cinderella Liberty. We went to Japan for a little Cinderella Liberty and then on to Okinawa, where we ended up staying for 3 months. we were the designated raider battalion, so we had to do all the stuff that went on for 3 weeks or so that Navy SEALs are known to do now. We'd work with the swimming and off the submarine and the beach landings and all the rappelling and all the stuff went on for 3 weeks. And then we went to the northern training area of Okinawa, where it's very thick jungle at high noon. You need a flashlight to get around. That's the area where up until the late 40s and early 50s, that people in America would hear about the Japanese holdouts from probably one of the last major battles of the Second World War was the Battle of Okinawa. And a lot of them fled into the northern training area where we trained and were still holdouts. And every now and again, they would shoot at the Marines that were up there training after the First World War, right into close to the Korean War. So we trained there for several weeks, and it was a different kind of training. They had a lot of problems with injuries, and they had something that I've never really got accustomed to, and that's after training with when there's snakes. I don't like snakes. They had a snake called the Habu. Habu was about as venomous as a rattlesnake, but as most people know, if you leave rattlesnakes alone, they'd leave you alone. But that's not the Habu. The Habu was a very aggressive snake who was known to chase people. If they ever bit you, they'd bite and they wouldn't let go. The Habu had killed many Ryukyuan Islanders, which Okinawa was part of the Ryukyuan Island chain. Kill many Ryukyuans every year, their bites would. So we had to be very careful where we stepped. If you saw a Habu, you want to go the other way because they'd come right after you. Little things like that. We were really actually looking forward to going to Vietnam. It was getting hot over there, but things were not so bad as that we were taking heavy casualties. Every now and again, there'd be a firefight, and we were given some orientation as to that, what was expected. We were told that once we got to Vietnam, we were going to take a ship down there. They're going to be a five-day journey. We'd do some training on the ship and be oriented as to what we were going to do when we got there. And our assignment was going to be airstrip security at the Da Nang Air Base. We were going to make a so-called wet tactical landing. That's the way they used to land in World War II, what they call wet nets. We'd go down these nets and get into these landing craft and land on the beach tactically because there were some firefights going on. VC were active around the airports, and so the plan was to land us tactically, and we would tactically move to the airstrip where we would take charge of the security there because the security was light and they'd been having snipings there, and every now and again a mortar round would come in at the airport. So my battalion was first, it was now the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, who would end up having one of the more ominous nicknames given a battalion over there, and that was the Walking Dead. It was a few years later because of the amount of casualties, but it didn't start out that way. It started out fairly late. So when we made the wet net landing, it was kind of strange for us because we came ashore and there were other people standing around, U.S. military personnel, just waiting there, some of them sunbathing, some of them smoking cigarettes, a couple more having a cold beer. So it looked kind of silly for us, but we were loaded up into the six bys and continued on with our so-called mission to the airstrip. And we got to the airstrip and we were assigned different areas to secure it, basically, permanently. To the east, the Air Force already had things set up. It turns out that Da Nang Air Base at the time was probably the busiest mall base in the entire world because we had started bombing runs out to the north, and they were very active doing that. And that was the importance, the general importance of Da Nang Air Base, to keep it secured with all of these jet fighters there that were running to the north constantly. This was going on day and night. Our security was basically on the west side of the strip. The east side, like I said, was pretty much taken up by the Air Force with their securities. We set up by a small village called, we nicknamed it Dog Patch, a small village on the west side, which wasn't a real problem. It was pacified for the most part. Some of the villagers actually worked on the airbase. So we were set up between the village and the airbase. We also had the south end fairly secured, but the south end was mostly concertina wire, which is basically razor wire, triply stacked. And the reason that we had no personnel permanently there was because the jets would take off from the south and they'd come back around and move north into their bombing runs into the north. And they would land from the north into the south. So there's no reason that we would want to be in the south end, because while I was there, we recall at least two jets piled up on the other end, the end of the south and blew up because they had bombs. One day, one of them took off and was having problems. He was going to come in and crash in the south end of the strip. So he wanted to relieve himself of his bombs, which he did on the airstrip, kind of got everybody running around with all these bombs going off in the middle of the strip. And then he piled up on the end of the strip. That probably saved his life. As he got out and walked away, basically. But we had another one crash, and the guy wasn't so lucky. So that was problems. And every now and then, we'd get a sniping. And we were dug in with holes, fighting holes, some Marines call them. And we had tents. It went on like this, and it was told that eventually we would move off the strip once we were relieved, because the Marine Corps wanted to start patrols moving south from the Da Nang airstrip into an area called Marble Mountain, where we had established a headquarters, a battalion headquarters at Marble Mountain, which was a large mountain right on the China Sea, alongside the sea there, where we had also a helicopter location, where there were going to be patrols run out of there using the helicopters and also foot patrols. So eventually we were looking at that, but we didn't know when. Meantime, the intelligence, so-called intelligence, came down. They came down with their reports, and that's another thing. There wasn't a whole lot of accurate intelligence at the time, but I was a squad leader. As a squad leader, I had three teams, three fire teams with four men each. I had a radio man and usually a Navy corpsman, and we had trained as a squad for 2 years. I was a corporal at the time. It was a sergeant's billet. But we had had training together for over 2 years, a lot of training, and we were very close, and we knew each other very well. And so I felt very confident in our patrols, and once we got started, and we didn't know when that was. But as a squad leader, I had intelligence reports every day through my platoon commander and our company commander. One of the intelligence reports had the Viet Cong supposedly had threatened that they were going to overrun the Da Nang Air Base, and this was going to happen on the 4th of July, which again was so-called intelligence. We didn't think a whole lot of it. In fact, we had kind of a laugh because we had had very minor contact at the time, so minor that as a squad leader in the tents at night, we would have minimal security out in the fighting holes. We would sleep in the tents at night. And as a squad leader, I would sleep at the end, and we had cots for the squad in the smaller tent. And the company was broke up into smaller tents, with each squad maintaining their unanimity together, sleeping in the same place. The situation was that everybody had their rifles, and at that time we had M14 rifles, 20-round magazines. There was still a little concern for the, I guess, the government, for the media, I don't know, but there was a pacification, ongoing pacification situation that would take place with the locals. For whatever reason, they didn't want, not want us to have loaded weapons, which sounds like an awful stupid thing being in a combat zone, but it was, and it wasn't a combat zone. They didn't want to push it too much, I guess, at this point. So as a squad leader, I had a big long box and I had all the ammunition, but my men had their M14 rifles, but I had all their magazines, loaded magazines. So I had dozens of magazines loaded with all the M14 ammunition. And I had all of the grenades because everybody had been issued M26 fragmentation grenades. So I had this long ammo box with perhaps, oh, maybe 40 magazines in there and probably a couple dozen fragmentation grenades. I also had flares and I had all of the munitions right next to my cot. In case we needed them, they would have to come down and line up there in my cot, and I'd be passing out the magazines and usually two frags to each Marine. Fragmentation grenade, you had to be very careful with them. In order for them to detonate, you'd have to hold them, and there's a so-called spoon. You'd straighten out the pin, you'd pull the pin, and it's not live until you let go of the spoon. You've got 5 to 6 seconds, which doesn't seem like a long time, and it isn't, unless you have to do something with it. And so you got to be really careful with frag grenades. And I would complain to my lieutenant and others at the time that if something does happen here, we're going to have a big problem getting the magazines out. We're also going to have a problem with these grenades. We haven't really been in any real combat situations to this point, other than a sniper now and again. You're not going to learn anything from that except to stay down low. So we're moving right along, and here it comes. It's June or July 1. So we've been here for 2 weeks. A little bit of probing, like I said, now and again, and nothing else. So it's July the 1st, and it's about 3 a.m., and this is the first time that we had come under mortar fire. The VC opened up on the strip with mortar fire right in the middle of the airstrip. And that was the initial attack. The reason for that was probably tactical on their part, because it separated the Marines who were securing the strip from the west to the Air Force on the east. The Air Force had very light security. They had a bunker on the corner. They had triple concertina, which again is razor wire. You wouldn't want to get caught into that because it would cut you up. And so this is would keep most people away. But the Viet Cong found a way to get around that. After they laid down the mortar barrage, it kept up. They hit the one bunker, the Air Force bunker, probably with a 57 recoilless, which blew it up. There were two Air Force security guys that actually got through it. And unbeknownst to us at the time, the VC had thrown these hinged gates over the concertina, and they all came scampering over to the concertina onto the strip. Hear all the screaming. I'd gotten out as soon as the first rounds. A lot of things happened at the same time. As the first rounds came in, I got out of my cot. And obviously we knew right away that something was wrong. We were under fire. We didn't know how much. We didn't know what the situation was. It caught us cold. Everybody was sleeping, except the minimal security we had. But again, they're on the west side looking west. The VC came from the east. We knew we were separated by this mortar barrage. But it didn't stop two Air Force guys from running right through it. They were panicked. And neither one of them got hit. I don't know how they made it. But they got through to our side. So I got out of my cannon. I not only had all the ammunition next to my cot, But I had these 10-gallon bottles of containers of water. And one of them, it usually is a cap that ties down, but it wasn't tied down. So first thing I did is I didn't have my boots on, and I ran into the one water tank that was full. And I knew it ran right into it, and I knew it had broken my right toe. And I went down on the ground, the water knocked over. I slipped and fell into the mud. The rounds were still coming in. People are screaming. People are hollering. So I rolled over and I'm passing out the magazines. It's dark in there. Somebody grabbed a flashlight. All of a sudden, we have a couple lights going, and I'm trying to pass out the magazines. And the guys are running outdoors. Still mortars are coming in. We didn't know what we had, except when you go outside and the mortars are perhaps, I don't know, 40, 50 feet in front of you, you're not going to run out of the mortars. So they had nothing to do but get down in defensive positions. When I got out there, I looked around on the other side and I saw all these VC running around with these satchel charges, throwing with jets, blowing one jet up after the other. And I was thinking that, you know, Ho Chi Minh had bragged about overrunning the base, and it wasn't July 4th, it was July 1st, but they did exactly as they said they were going to do. And they blew up a lot of planes. And then it was over. They all went over, ran right over these hinge gates that they'd come on. Took no casualties, but we took several. Not on the Marine side, but the Air Force did. Needless to say, that was the very last day in Vietnam, in the 11 months that I was there, that we spent in a tent. The very last day. The next day, well, the next day was already there because it was about 3:30 in the morning. We're looking at our wounds. And then we were given the word that we'd be moving out that day, moving south towards Marble Mountain. We'd set up a combat CP, and we would start doing our patrolling from there. We were relieved the next day. The next day, 24 hours later, we were fully relieved. Like I said, the tents came down, and we would do what Marines do in a combat situation. We'd dig what we call the fighting hole. The Army calls them foxholes. We call them fighting holes. We moved out by foot. No, nothing happened here by helicopter yet. And we ended up in Marble Mountain, which is a few miles south of the air base. And from Marble Mountain, we dug in as a company position. We had tanks at that location. It was a very fortified area, so we wouldn't be staying there. We'd be moving south from there and set up a company position, which is a lot smaller, obviously, than the battalion. A Marine Corps company is about 220 men. And it was my company, A Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. And we went south and, for the first time, set up our first company position right outside the beach. And we dug in. And this began my 11 months, now down to about 10 months, in Vietnam. We continually ran mostly squad and platoon patrols out of that base. We saw quite a bit of action. Some days were worse than others. Many times we were ambushed. We started losing people. The mortar rounds came in a company position about every night, and there were snipers every day. A couple of funny stories there, but funny now when they're funny back then. But sometimes you'd find yourself in a funny position. Like we all have to relieve ourselves from time to time, and we had a four-holer once. We're four holes, self-described. You'd sit on them and do your business, and it was right down in the middle of our compound, the position, company position had set up. And usually every evening and night, when the sun goes down, it's probably during the daytime, the most difficult time to make things out. When it's turning from light to dark, and that's when we usually get mortared. So when one night this evening, there was a guy down there on the four-holer, and the rounds started coming in. And the four-holer was on hinged gates, sitting up. And he was in a little bit of a hurry, so he got up and kicked the four-holer, underneath, and he lost his balance, and he went down 15 feet into the bottom of this four-holer, where he ended up at the bottom in a pile of poop. And it was kind of embarrassing. Not pretty serious then, but kind of how you can laugh at it. But those types of things happened. you laugh about them later. There were several things that happened like that, but generally we went out and it was all business. We would find little pockets of EC from time to time. Actually, on a patrol once, we walked right into a little VC outlet where they had set up, and it was during the daytime. And my point man had run into a lookout, VC lookout, who was on a hill, and there was a little cove that went down into the right on the ocean. And they ran into each other, and all of a sudden, apparently, this VC lookout guard was sound asleep when my man walked up on him, and they both jumped, looked at each other. And I was right behind him, and this VC jumps up, and he sees us coming towards his little group. He jumps up screaming and ran over the hill and down the side, and I ran after him and looked down. And there's like a little area down there about the size of this pool out here, a small area. And there's about 30 VC down there having a drill, a short order drill, two groups of like a dozen. And they're actually drilling them, military type of drilling back and forth. And this guy comes running down the field and he's yelling at him down the hill. And we come running up behind him, and they're just all looking up at us. And we're looking down at them, and all of a sudden they split back into their huts to arm themselves, because they didn't have any weapons initially. They were just doing short order drills, common to military units anywhere. And then they were coming out with rifles, so we ended up getting into a little bit of a firefight. I backed people off because we were fairly exposed and we were right by the ocean. So I set up a 180 with the ocean as a backdrop and dug in and called in artillery. At that time we had artillery. We also had naval gunfire that I was able to call in. We did the coordinates and I was able to call it in, and we wiped that village out, quite frankly. But it was an ammo dump. It was a training facility for the VC. So we got lucky, and things worked out that particular day. Other days, like September 9th, they didn't work out. Certain days that you remember, the dates, you remember what happened specifically, and September 9th was one of them. September 9th of 65, we were on an operation moving south from our company positions, and this was two companies, so it was a larger operation. Intelligence reports said there was a large force of VC working in the area, so we were to do a sweeping motion starting mid-morning, basically, moving down south from our company position with two companies. Our company, A Company, would be online, and we had the company on its line between the ocean, again, which is the China Sea on the east, and on the west, it was nothing but rice paddies. Now, rice paddies have what we call dikes separating them that were maybe 2 to 3, some of them little higher, separating us. So we were up in the sandy portions, and our west flank was where my platoon was. And that would be the end of that flank, and we would move the sweeping movement south. Behind us, we had two companies trailing us. We also had a platoon of tanks, which is 5 tanks, and a platoon of Antoses. An Antos was a small tank with 6 106-millimeter recoilless rifles, 3 mounted on either side. Very effective, with a lot of firepower. So this is a very large operation. We're moving south, and obviously you could hear us coming a long ways away because tanks are loud, but they were in the rear of our company position as we were moving south. Those were the Antoses sprinkled in between the companies. we had good communication. Everything was moving, and the first rounds came in right on top of us. 60-millimeter mortars, and basically wiped out several of my guys in my platoon. They were right down on top of us. When the mortars first come in, the first instinct is you get down. And hopefully the mortars back off, and then you can get moving around, organize people. But you don't know what happens until it happens, quite frankly. So the first mortar came in and took out, I think, three of our guys. And they kind of lightened up, and then the snipers opened up. Unbeknownst to us, there were snipers in trees. They were in camouflaged holes, spider holes, we called them. They opened up. As I moved around, I'm trying to get my squad together, yelling at them. Meanwhile, the tanks were moving up. One of the Antosas had got hit, a direct hit. And there was a staff sergeant that crawled out of it. Both of his arms had been blown off, and he was looking at his two bloody stumps. And I don't say this for effect to impress anybody, but I'm trying to get across what happened, really what happened. He's yelling. He's in shock, obviously. Guys are dropping, and then it rains. The rain starts coming in, and it rained hard. I found myself behind one of these dikes that I'd mentioned with three of my guys, Danny Enriquez, my point man, and we were like familiar to the camera, laying down flat. And two of my other guys were behind me, and we were caught in a so-called kill zone, and were pinned down because the rifle fire was popping up all around us. And we knew this is, I pissed my pants, quite frankly. And I'm sure others did too, because this was it. There's no way to get out of this. And Danny, which was, he always questioned stuff. It's just his personality. He was just a hell of a good Marine, though. Did what he did very well. And his face was down like this, and my face was down like that. We're like a foot apart. And he says, Lang, what are we going to do? I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to die right here. Unfortunately, we're going to do. So it just came to me. My weapon at the time was an M79 grenade launcher. Very effective for this type of situation. It had a frag, 395 pieces of fragmentation, and a small grenade about half the size of your fist. And you could pop one out, and it had a killing radius of about 6 meters, and about 12 meters of fragmentation would go out. So I just would stick my head up over the top of the barrel, and I'd put out one round after the other. And all of a sudden, the sniper fire just kind of went away. I put out four rounds, and every time I put out, I was going to say, I'm going to yell your name, get out the back. And so I started yelling guys' names, and as I did, I would put another round out front. And by the time the last one was Enriquez, and I yelled Enriquez, I was Danny, and he got out, and there was hardly anybody shooting at us. By the time I got out, I put another round out in front, and it was only one guy shooting at us. So the M79 rounds work. Things began to calm down after that. We got a hold of things. And I ran out, and I'm trying to get my guys together. Everybody was everywhere, people screaming and hollering. Mortars had stopped. The rain has slightly stopped, down to a drizzle. And it went out to a knoll there that overlooked the rice paddy. And I saw eight, what I thought were Marines. They had on the backpacks and helmets. I said, boy, they didn't look like our helmets, though. And I had my M79, and I said, well, they're running across the rice paddy, and they're going out of here. So it must be somebody got their squad together, and they're going after it. And they did double take, and I said, oh, they're Marines. They weren't Viet Cong either. They were NVA. They were North Vietnamese Army. This was the first time we'd ever encountered the NVA. And they were moving across with my M79, so I'm going to start shooting at them. And they're right on top of them. And the next thing I know, they're gone. Because they'd made it across the rice paddy. We'd called in airstrikes. So the airstrikes came in and were very effective because they had set up their CP on the other side of the North Vietnamese, the other side of the rice paddy. And they were well dug in. And this is where they had run their ambush out of, and where they'd set things up. This is where they had their 60-millimeter mortar set in, where they hit us initially from. The people that I saw running across were all the snipers they had on our side. And, well, we hit a couple of them. That was it. But they just basically, we were hit cold, and we took a whole lot more casualty than they did until the airstrikes came in. When the airstrikes came in, they wiped out just about every one of them. I guess they estimated they killed about 120 of them. That was the first major fight we had. It was pretty nasty because you learned lessons and you learned them the hard way. This wasn't the type of war we were going to fight by in the middle of the daytime going online where every villager knew where you were. And this was a problem we had throughout because these were villagers who the NVA and the Viet Cong used as intelligence, rightfully so. We didn't have any right to be there, and this was their home that we've invaded. And while we did what we had to do while we were there, the obvious thing is we sure as hell shouldn't have been there to begin with. So they were fighting for their own lands, you know, and they ended up killing, what, 1.5 million of their people for what? We lost a lot of our own for what? That made me very bitter, and I that was my problem for a long time. But it was a lot of people's problem for a long time. But that was basically the start, and after then, sorry to say, but it didn't get any better. It got worse. Vietnam identified me with the way I'd be the rest of my life. It changed me in a lot of ways that were very negative for a long time. Things do change though over time, and I guess I got lucky in marriage. I got very lucky with that in my family. Had a good career. It wasn't always negative. Sometimes you're your own worst enemy, I think. And you got to give yourself a chance, and maybe I didn't do that. But a lot of things happened for a reason. Just don't know what it is at the time. When we're out on patrol, we, of course, have a point man who'd be the first to run into anything. And we'd always go in a broken column, one after the other. Move very carefully and very slowly. Patrols aren't always at night. Sometimes they're in the daytime. Be just as careful, if not more so, because there were trip wires that the VC would lay with the explosive devices like a CHICOM, Chinese Communist grenades. They'd tie little pieces of a catgut, like nylon, to the pin that had already been straightened out. You'd trip into the nylon, it would pull the pin out, and 6 seconds later, the CHICOM grenade would explode and probably kill anything within 10 feet of it, 12 feet of it. We had that happen more than a couple times. So this is something the point man would look at. The other thing that sometimes we went across would be gates that had grenades attached to them. It would be pretty obvious sometimes. If there's no other way to get from point A to point B, you'd have to go through a fence line, but there'd be a gate that you'd have to go through, and it would be booby-trapped with one of these grenades. So you'd have to be very careful, obviously. What we didn't learn initially was that there were many times secondary booby traps, if you will. I'd call one incident. As a squad leader, I would kind of take that upon myself to disarm the booby traps. And of course, one way we would do it is just to explode the grenade, perhaps with one of our grenades. That would take care of the entire problem, plus the gate. So we came across this gate one day, and it was at the catgut down below, and it was all tied to a Chinese Chi-Com grenade, which tells you, obviously, that the Chinese supplied the Vietnamese with a lot of their weaponry. Well, that's another story. So it was obvious here that there was a grenade there, and that the intent was for us to see the grenade and disarm it. Otherwise, they would have hit it. Why would they do that? Well, that's because it's probably a secondary situation. And this particular one is kind of innovative. The gate was by itself, and the only way to get from our point to the other side would have been to go through the gate. So I was going to blow that gate with one of our grenades, the M26 frag grenade, and it would have taken care of the gate, the Chi-Com grenade, the cat gut, and everything else, and we'd blow it, and we'd move through to where we're going. So that was the plan. So what you want to do, obviously, is get the entire squad covered area. There was several rocks around. There was a dike and a rice paddy. So I had my guys behind the rice paddy, behind this rock, farther enough away that when I detonated my grenade, it would only, wipe out anything that was probably within 20 feet of the gate. So I wanted to get everybody secure, everybody down, everybody under cover. And when I did that, I looked for a place for myself. Let's say 15 to 20 feet from the gate was a huge hole, just a big excavation. And I went over and I kind of looked into the hole, and there was nothing there, but just a big old hole. And if I could roll my grenade into the gate, I got 5 or 6 seconds, sometimes 7, which is plenty of time to turn around and jog over 15, 20 feet, jump in the hole, cover myself up, the grenade would go off, blow the gate out, mission accomplished, I'd get up and we'd continue on our way. So like I said, I looked into the hole, didn't see anything. And I went back and made sure everybody was down. And I got my M26 and I pulled the pin, and I had the spoon, so I had it as long as I wanted if I held the spoon. So I looked over, and from here to the hole, it was clear. I could have almost could have crawled over. I was that close. So I dropped the gate and I rolled it, the grenade, and I rolled it towards the gate. And I turned around and I jogged over and I jumped in the hole and I covered up. And I looked down and there was a snake under the hole. The snake was called a crate. A crate is a very venomous snake in Southeast Asia. Very venomous. And I looked and I knew I had 3 or 4 seconds to make a decision here. I jump up away from the crate and I'm going to get my head blown off. If I stay down there, I might get bit by the crate, but I have my boots on, my jungle boots. He's kind of wrapping himself around there, but he's not too tight, not too close. So I stayed with the snake. It was a good choice. The grenade went off and blew the gate out. That's what we wanted to do, and I jumped up and looked down, and the crate was still crawling. Well, I didn't see him when I looked in there because the hole was concave. The hole was dug in the bottom. It's like a beaker. A beaker is narrow at the top and gradually widens out to the bottom. And the curvature in the bottom is much larger than the opening. And this was what the cave was. I believe it's called a concave structure or whatever, concave hole. And the snake had crawled around on the outskirts or the outer part of that, of the bottom, so I couldn't see him when I glanced in there. Luckily for me, he'd probably been there a while. Maybe with malnutrition, he was probably dying. For whatever reason, he never bit me. But that was what we call an unofficial, maybe a secondary booby trap that they probably did on purpose, knowing some dumb jarhead would jump in the hole with a snake. That's exactly what happened. We got a kind of a kick out of that, but I suppose if I'd gotten bit, it wouldn't have been much to laugh about. Then there was the tunnel. There were a lot of tunnels that were dug by the VC, And they would store ammo in there and foodstuffs. Even some of their people would hide in various tunnels from time to time. Part of our duties had to do with checking these tunnels out. And everybody is probably familiar with the term tunnel rat. We usually had to have someone go in the tunnels and check them out for whatever, for ammunition or food or maybe even bodies. It could be anything in a tunnel. You didn't know. That's what made going into a tunnel so scary. You didn't know what you were going to find. Usually these tunnels were on the small side, so a guy that's 6 foot, 200 pounds, you probably wouldn't want him going down in the tunnel. He might get stuck, I guess. I don't know. So we looked at our smaller Marines, the smaller guys, to be our so-called tunnel rats. And we had one fellow from by the name of Ivan Hiller. Ivan was from New Mexico. Good Marine. And every now and again, he was a short stature, not a big guy. Obviously, he had some courage, as he said he would go down there when I requested that of him. He was on my squad. What we do generally is give them a flashlight and a 45 automatic in case they ran into anything that they had a problem with. They would have that 45 in their hand with them. So you got a picture of a smaller guy getting down on his hands and knees and crawling face down. Much of it on elbows and knees, crawling back into these tunnels with a flashlight in one hand and a 45 auto in the other, moving very slowly. And he'd gotten in and he'd crawling back and he hadn't been in there but a few seconds to check it out, this particular tunnel. And he was yelling and hollering. And hear this screaming. And he came back out just about as fast as he went in, which is a little unusual because it's tough to crawl backwards. But he says, something in there. By the time he got out, there's something in there. Ran into it. Well, we'd heard this story sometimes. As I said earlier, booby trap, the VC would use these crates, these snakes, as booby traps, weapons, whatever have you. If you got bit, you know, you were in big problems. So he apparently had run into one of these crates, but when I put the flashlight in, I looked around in there, it's hanging by the top from the cave down. It was just hanging there. There's a crate. In fact, I think there were two of them. And they were hanging from the top. They were fastened somehow to the top of the tunnel hanging down. So that someone who crawled in there, if they were still alive, they'd be bit. The snakes aren't going anywhere. They're just hanging there. They were both dead, probably from malnutrition. They may have been hanging in there for days. I don't know. But, of course, Ivan and anybody else had heard the stories that how the VC used these snakes as booby traps. And apparently that's what they did here. And luckily for our guy and the rest of us, they were dead. Yeah, I guess just another lesson, how clever that the VC were and what they did. And if something like that would have happened, I mean, you can imagine the injury, the possibly producing death alone, but the effect that something like that would have on morale. They thought these things through. Yeah, I mentioned earlier, September 9th of 65, we got hit pretty bad, and when you get hit, direct hit with a mortar round, I mean, there's not a whole lot left, let's just put it the way it is. It's not like after something like this and you're cleaning up the mess. I mean, it is a mess. The first thing we would do is we would have to care for our dead, quite frankly. And get their bodies out. It's not like a crime scene that I later on got so used to where criminals would show up and photographers would show up and we'd photograph everything and measure everything and do this and do that. And not like that at all. We just had to get the bodies out of there for every reason that one could imagine. And there's not going to be any investigation. They got killed in a firefight. They were killed with a mortar round. They died in combat. And it's up to us to get their bodies out and return their bodies home. We didn't have a whole lot of body bags. We had what we call ponchos. A poncho is a plastic rain cover. It's not a raincoat, it's a cover that's made to cover you. It's got a head you can put your, around your head, but it's wide, where it would also cover your weapon and perhaps your sleeping bag and anything else around you. So it was large, and you could snap it up, and it snapped. So that was one way we would remove bodies with. Sometimes the bodies were all in one piece. Many times they weren't in one piece. There's not a whole lot of science that goes behind this. You get the body pieces you have, and you put them in the poncho. You clip it up, and in this instance, you put the bodies where they're supposed to be when we, of course, called in air support. In this particular case, as with normal, we used air medevacs, not just for the wounded, which we had several wounded here. One of my best friends lost his leg there. He almost lost his life. And he was right in front of me. He got hit, direct hit, and he lived. He died a few years later, but he lived through that. Anyway, we had another guy that got killed, named Jimmy Mailer from Boston, Massachusetts, and he took a direct hit. When we were putting him in there, we had another guy named Barney Boyer who got killed. He got hit, direct hit, and he was still on fire, lying about 30 feet away. He mortared around and started a fire, some brittle leaves and stuff around him, and he was on fire. We couldn't even get close to him. He'd obviously dead because there wasn't that much left of him. We had to wait till the fire went out to get to him. In the meantime, we had Jim, and we put him in a poncho and clipped him up, and the chopper had landed. And by now it was getting dark, and there wasn't much left of Mailer. And in fact, you couldn't tell where his head was. You couldn't tell where his limbs were. You'd see something sticking out of just a glob of human flesh, no other way to put it. So we rolled what we had into the poncho, and for whatever reason, I don't recall there being a whole lot of blood, even though there had to have been a lot of blood, but the bodies, what was left, just, he must have bled out initially, most of it initially, because there just wasn't that much blood. But we rolled what we had into the poncho, and me and another guy carried it over to the chopper, and the gunner was there. Well, the choppers had a gunner that manned an M60 machine gun. And he kind of moved to the side as we came in with Mailer in the poncho, and there was some body fluids dripping out of the poncho, and obviously, I have to say, it was very unpleasant scene, and putting up, and I promised Jim was a good sized guy, and we had to kind of heft him up from the floor under the chopper, and it was, you know, 3 feet up or so, 3.5, 4 feet. And we're putting him on there and kind of pushing him in and over, and we're looking at someone inside to maybe get the back of it and pull him in a little bit more, and the gunner kind of moved to the side a little bit and was going to help us a little bit. And then one of the crewmen was back there, and he looked at the poncho and what was in it, and he said, looked at me, he says, "Get that thing off of here." And I was stopped, and I was in shock. I said, "What the hell did he mean, get that thing off of here?" He was talking about Mailer, and it wasn't a thing, it was Jim Mailer. And I wanted to shoot him. I said, "I can't, though. As you said, he's going on here," something to that effect. "He's one of our guys, and he's coming on here." And I wanted to shoot that guy so bad. I didn't. So we got him on there, and that was that. But things happen very quickly, and you got to make decisions, and sometimes people aren't in a in a position to make decisions, and so they don't, and that's a mistake. Do this or do that, but sitting on the fence just didn't cut it. Every few months, they'd come and airlift us out of our company position. And that had a couple of things, a couple of reasons for that. Your company position, after a while would get well known, and you don't want to stay in one place too long because the enemy will find out where you are. And they'll set you up for all sorts of things, like snipers at night, mortar rounds. We always used to get one or two mortar rounds as the sun went down because it's hard to see stuff at that time. And so one good reason to leave the company position was because it became too well known and they didn't want to stay there too long. Because let's just say we were an uninvited guest into their country. And frankly, again, I don't blame them for that. But so you'd move your company position. And part of the moving would be they'd chopper us into the to the rear, if there was such a thing, back to the Marble Mountain command post, the battalion command post, 19th battalion command post, where it was relatively secure, where they had tents that you could actually sleep in at night. It was as secured as you could get under those conditions. Also, we'd be back there 2 or 3 days, and we would have hot food. We never had hot food in the field. We always ate sea rations out of a can. So we'd get hot meals for those 2 or 3 days, get to sleep in the relative security of the tents. And it was just kind of like an R&R for 2 or 3 days. And we'd get haircuts back there, and we'd get hot showers. All those things we never got while we were in the field, so it was a big deal for us to be moving around every month or two. We enjoyed going to the rear. Once our time was up, we'd get back in the choppers and we'd go out and we'd make a landing somewhere, a predetermined area, tactically area only that would be favorable to us, supposedly, and set up another CP, a brand new one. And we'd dig our fighting holes again, set up everything again, and begin a new company position. And again, initiate squad and platoon size patrols operating out of that particular one. So, taking us back, when you're back there and you're doing all these wonderful things, you're getting your hot showers, hot food, getting your haircuts, sleeping in a nice place at night, you're also a bailout reserve. Your company is. Like I said earlier, company is about 220 men. We've got machine guns attached to it. Usually one or two teams per platoon. So we well fairly well armed. Automatic rifles, like I said, as a squad leader, I had 3 4-man teams. One was an automatic rifleman, the other 3 were regular riflemen. I had an M79 grenade launcher, very effective. We had a 2-man M60 machine gun team. This is just one squad. A platoon has 3 of these squads. So we had 3 4 platoons basically in a company. So we were well armed. We'd been out there a while. We knew that the score was doing this and doing that. The one drawback of being in the rear, though, was if something happened where they needed you to bail somebody out and you had to be there in a hurry, we were back there sleeping next to the helicopters for a reason. So while we were back there, we had one of those emergencies where we were called out. And when you're called out back there, you got to be ready to go now, which we were. The old expression, you sleep with your boots on. This was in the afternoon, I don't know, 2-3 in the afternoon, I guess. We were laid out, the guys were napping, just taking it easy and being joyed. You're not in a tactical situation now out in the field. You're back in the rear where you can relax a little bit and take a nap if you want. But if it's the bell sounds, you got to respond. Well, the bell sounded, and what we had a platoon that was pinned down in an area west of us, several miles west of us, and the area was called the Horseshoe. The Horseshoe was just that. It was a horseshoe river. was a horseshoe within the river. In other words, it was curved in a certain area where they had land between the curvatures. This particular area was, if you looked at a complete circle, the curvature in the river is about probably close to 180 degrees. In other words, about half of the circle that was the horseshoe. And it was a platoon that had been apparently caught in the horseshoe, but we didn't have a whole lot of information at the time. But they were caught there, and they were having a hell of a fight. They were pinned down. So the Marine Corps' answer was, we get on helicopters and we go and do what we can. We're en route. We don't know what's going on. We don't know what we have. So we got saddled up. It didn't take any time at all. We were ready to go. And we had initially our company, and another company was right after us. So we had plenty of people en route. At least we thought we did. And we headed out that way, and it took, actually, I don't know, 20 minutes, 25 minutes to get there by air. It was quite a ways out. And when we got there, it was still light, but it was kind of starting to get dark, but it wasn't yet. We had perhaps a dozen choppers with us and a dozen more on the way behind us. So we were sending plenty of help to these guys. But when we got there in the area, we got the word it's down below. So I'm waiting, we trained in helicopters, and we had a procedure we followed. And just before we hit the ground, the first team out would run straight out, and we'd span out and make a 180 on the choppers that landed with my 12 guys, and it'd be 14. We'd have a gun team with us. But they knew exactly where to go when we hit the ground. And as a squad leader, I was the last one out, and I'd come up behind the squad who was setting up the 180 on the chopper, regardless of the situation, not just this particular situation, but anyone. Sometimes if you were getting shot at, then you couldn't do that. So you'd have to be a little more careful and maybe hit the ground before you started running out to your position, if you had a pre-plan or whatever. Based on the bottom line, you didn't know. So we circled, and all of a sudden it's getting dark, and I couldn't understand why are we still circling. So the choppers circled and circled and circled. Well, they didn't tell us what was going on, and apparently the fighting had stopped on the ground, and we were still circling, and all of a sudden it's dark. So we get the word we're going to make a tactical landing in the dark, which is it's not a good thing to do, and it's not fun. You don't know what you got down there. But the shooting had stopped. That was a good part. But the word was we would land and secure the area and decide what we're going to do after we secured the area. So I'm thinking if there had been a firefight, you got to have some guys got hit, and they're going to need to medevac. And so this will work. We'll bail out of these choppers. I think the first dozen or so choppers were all spread out over this field. And in the background, you could see the river. And I forgot the name of the river. There are two or three different horseshoes and two or three different rivers. And for some reason, that I'll explain in a second, they were very popular as ambush positions. We were all going to land about the same time. And I figured the wounded would be taken out on the choppers that we landed on. Real quick over to the side, these horseshoes were popular. You don't want to get caught in a horseshoe in an ambush because you're cut off. You want to be able to bug out the rear if possible in an ambush. If you got a river behind you and you're caught in a horseshoe, you got nowhere to bug out. You got to stay right there and fight your way out. And it's not always a good idea to do if you're outnumbered. If you got nobody to bail you out, if you're pinned down with mortars, machine guns, you don't want to get caught in a horseshoe. Well, this patrol apparently had gotten caught in a horseshoe in the middle of it when they got ambushed by a much larger force, I'm going to say. There were 33 of them, this platoon. So that was the idea, that the fighting had stopped. We would land, set up a security perimeter, wait till it got light, secure the area, and then decide what was going to happen. In the meantime, I'm assuming we're going to get the wounded out of there best we can. So we landed and spread out and did everything good, and then all the choppers took off. I remember moving out right behind mine, and I looked up, and there's a young lieutenant who had his group in front of mine, and I yelled over at him. It's kind of a melodramatic thing to say, but it wasn't at the time. I didn't know what was going on because I had jumped off the helicopter and tripped over something. Later on, apparently it was a boot, it was a leg of a dead Marine. And I just kept going. I didn't understand any of that, what was going on. I didn't see it at first. Anyway, I'm setting up and I yelled over at this lieutenant, who do I tie in with? Because we'd tie in my man with his to make sure we had a secured perimeter around where we were setting up. And he looked over at me and said, God, I'll never forget that. A little melodramatic, but I guess I understand it better now because he had seen a little more than I had. Because he knew that every one of those Marines was dead, and I didn't know that. So we set up, and all night long we had incoming artillery, our artillery, to keep the enemy at bay, supposedly. I don't know who made that decision. But the entire night we had artillery coming in on our perimeter, out so that we wouldn't get hit and run. So we were there the entire night. And we stayed, dug in a little bit, and set up this perimeter. It was a long night, very long night, until the sun started to come up. And artillery stopped just about the time the sun had come up. Now, our sun was off to our east, obviously. It was kind of to the side of the river going from east to west. And we could look at where I was off kind of towards the east side of the perimeter, and I could see the horseshoe and this open ground. It was all open ground, no dikes, no hills, not a lot of grass. It was just kind of an open area that this platoon had been caught out in the middle of. And in the background, he had this horseshoe. So it was either an incorrect tactical move, perhaps they were moving along because there was heavy brush off to both sides and all of a sudden they found themselves out in the open. I don't know what it was, we'll never know. But they found themselves out in the open in this area. And as I looked out over this open area, all I could see was dead Marines as far as I could see. And there were 33 of them that were killed that day. Decision was made, we'd bring in the choppers and load all the bodies up. Again, there's no crime scene investigation here. There's no photographs and no recordation of any of this, except what you see with your own mind and your own eyes and what you put into your memory. But my memory of that seems as clear today, all those years ago, that it was back then. Because I remember exactly what I looked at, with 33 dead Marines. And as we were getting them together, we lined the bodies up, and none of them had any boots on, because after they were shot, killed, caught in ambush, one thing, the North Vietnamese, mostly more Viet Cong than North Vietnamese, we had superior gear, and we had these jungle boots, which were very good, built for the jungle. And all their boots were gone. Somebody had taken all their boots, taken all their personal items. Zippo lighters, because everybody smoked. Canteens, all their 782 gear, we called it, the web gear. Their backpacks, their wristwatches, their rings, their dog tags. Their weapons, obviously, they took all their weapons. In some cases, they took the shirts right off their backs. But what got to me was... they made sure that they bayoneted every one of them after they shot them. So I remembered they had to make sure they were dead. Now, who knows if they were all dead or not? I don't know. I just imagine those young kids lying there, shot, and getting overrun by these these North Vietnamese or whoever they were coming out. It had to be North Vietnamese because of the bayonets. Viet Cong never were known to carry bayonets. So they bayoneted all the bodies. We'd line them up and we're putting them on choppers. And like I said, there were 33 of them. And we could get, oh gosh, there's the troop choppers. They weren't big, but they weren't all that big. They weren't real small either. We could probably, I think, get six bodies on the choppers. So we needed several choppers. We had five or six choppers that we were putting the bodies on. And all of them had landed at the same time, and we had different working parties putting the bodies on the choppers, because plus we'd still secured the area. The enemy, such as it were, as it was, were long gone. So we stacked the bodies on there, and again, we'd put ponchos on those that we could, but there were some where we didn't have enough ponchos. And so we just put the bodies on, and I remember looking at the chopper that we were putting bodies on, closest to me, and I saw two or three of these young guys, and they're all my, I was 20 years old, and they were all 19, 20-year-old kids, maybe 21. And some of them had their shirts on, some of them didn't. No gear, like I said, no helmets, no nothing, except the bodies. And it just struck me how weird this was, because every one of them had been in the rear, just like we were when they got called out. And they had all just gotten fresh haircuts, Marine Corps style, high and tight. Head shaved, had to be the day or two before, maybe 2 days before, just before they'd gone out on this ill-fated patrol. And I'd never forgotten that. Of all these horrible things that what got to me the most was they got haircuts. Why did they get haircuts? Well, because you think you're going to be around a while and you want to look good. You want to look sharp, you want to feel better. You had that hot shower, you got the shave maybe, and you had that haircut because you were happy just to get through another day. And how many of them, none of them had to know that the very next day they'd be slaughtered, their bodies humiliated. So that pisses you off. Well, it pisses me off, and I guess that's to say it lightly, and that stays with you and all it's, yeah, it stays with you today. I think about that, I think about this thing various times. A lot. Some people would say, oh, maybe you need to see a shrink. Well, if I did, it'd be a long time ago. I don't think I need that at all. But it's just something you think of that doesn't go away, and you deal with it because it really happened. Sometimes, like right now, I don't tell a story very often, but it, after all these years, actually helps me in a way to tell it. Why? I don't know. What really gets to me, though, was, again, that I've said this before, and I will all say this, there's no reason for us to have been there. I understand the Vietnamese people who have, people as a whole, I still have a regard for. Like, we killed a million of them, a million and a half of them or so. A lot of them weren't combatants. We killed them anyway. A lot of them were women and children, and that should have never happened because we should have never been there. And today that makes me even more mad than almost as mad as just looking at those bodies.